Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time of the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it is Friday, February 16th, 2024. I like to start each show, as you know, with a little what's in the news headline. This one will have nothing. Well, kind of, maybe, sort of connected to the conversation I'm about to have with my distinguished guest. Here's a headline in the New York Times. Sparks fly as DA in Georgia is grilled on her relationship. Now, I have two reactions to this. One is the political elitist that I am, which are scolding everybody for allowing our attentions to be diverted by what is clearly a political ruse by the Trump forces to create a non-existent conflict of interest in the case of Fani Willis, who's a Fulton County district attorney who's prosecuting Donald Trump for what is an obvious violation of election law. He clearly, they got him on tape, ladies. They got him on tape, man. It doesn't get more clear and obvious than that. Telling election officials in Georgia, just find me the votes. And he had the precise number. I can't remember the exact number. Monroe knows it by heart when he comes on the show Wednesday. He always recites it. The precise number of votes he needs to throw away to give Georgia to him. So the counterattack is the Trump forces got a hold through a divorce proceeding, a long, convoluted road of the accusations that Willis, Prosecutor Willis, had an affair with Nathan Wade, who was one of her attorneys that she hired to investigate Trump. I don't know how this is a conflict of interest, as they're saying, because they're on the same side. I mean, like, who cares if they had an affair? But, you know, that judge down there, he's bending over backwards to be fair to Trump. Everybody's bending over backwards to be fair to Trump. So they're having a hearing and a live deposition, if you will, of Willis. And it was absolutely a fascinating TV if you're a political junkie. So this is the second part of my response. The first part is, this is beneath us. This is just games, the games politicians play, to paraphrase a great song from the 60s. But the other part of me is I'm just such a junkie, and I'm just watching it unfold. And it reminds me of so many dramatic confrontations that took place earlier in my life in TV where, various witnesses came up against aggressive questioning in televised hearings. I think of the Clarence Thomas hearings back in 1990. I think of the Iran-Contra hearings in the 1980s. I think of the Watergate hearings in the 1970s. God, ladies and gentlemen, been around a long time. And these confrontations, and each side like stands behind its man. Like, we're so fired up. And I'm, you know, and yeah, I found myself yesterday, like, yeah, Fannie Wills, give him hell. And like all the other anti-Trumpers on the internet are taking clips of great moments where she just stood her ground. And it's like, yeah, don't let them push you around. But meanwhile, they're talking sex. And when Americans, you start talking sex, and that radar goes up. Man, talking sex is way more interesting than talking politics for most Americans. Let's just be honest about this. So everybody acts like, oh, no, Ben, that's beneath where I am. I am not just concerned about sex. Oh, yeah? Then how come you only tune in when they talk about it? There was like that Jesse Jackson routine he did on Saturday Night Live where like the radar would beep whenever they switch topics to sex. So anyway, fascinating show. Counterpunch by Fannie Willis as the Trump forces try to create a case of conflict of interest where none exists. Anything to avoid their client's obvious attempt to subvert democracy. All right, without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself, and we're going to have a conversation, but probably has nothing to do directly with what I just said. So, distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Hello there. My name is Pamon Rami, and I am a member of the board of the Illinois Arts Council, and an author, a professor at Loyola University. I also teach and instruct at the University of Chicago, teach digital storytelling there, international filmmaker, and a writer of curriculum. So those are some of the basic things. But I want to make one comment about what you said earlier.
Go.
You remember the Perry Mason show when it was on ages ago? Of course you do. Every time I see things in the press now, it takes me back to Perry Mason. And you expect someone to jump up at the end after lying for the whole show and then say, I did it, you caught me. And I think part of our behavior is shaped by what we either envision from television or what we've been trained for it to be. And I know a lot of people have become lawyers because of those TV shows, you know. So it's just tragic, I think, what all of this has become or gotten back to, depending on how you look at it. And the fact that you don't know who to trust in the media. We're inundated with so many different choices of what you believe. It's hard, you know, to move forward. And then you get requests from political people that are running all year long. You know, it's as soon as the last election is over, they start begging again. And every day you get somebody talking about somebody to give you some money. So it's been fascinating to watch. And it's definitely reality television.
Absolutely. So I don't know if you watch. I mean, again, I reached out to Pomoni's. This is his second appearance on the show. I said, hey, let's talk Oscars and Academy. The man spent his lifetime in movie making. He's also from Chicago, born and raised. I would love to hear your perspective on the Academy Awards, sort of like as an insider. So we'll get into that. But you're also a movie man. You spent your lifetime watching movies, working in movies, talking about movies, lecturing about movies, writing about movies. So to your point, this is reality TV. That's what it was. And you're absolutely correct. America has been trained to expect those Perry Mason moments, which probably 99.9% of the time do not exist. There's no one going to stand up and blurt out, I did it.
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
But there's a song, a country song. I don't know if you remember this song, Harbor Valley PTA.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of my favorite songs from the 60s, Pomone, where the singer castigates her accusers, that's saying they're all hypocrites because they're coming. She's a single mom and she wears mini skirts And she points out that all her accusers are all like perverted guys who are always trying to ask her for a date and stuff. And so she turns, he turns attack on them. And that is what people, that's part of my humble opinion. People, their responses, that's other, it's not just looking for that Perry Mason moment, which they are, but it's also cheering when your side points out the hypocrisy on the other side. And I found myself, like, that's where the reality TV part, cheering when Willis, I don't know if you've seen those clips where she just comes strong. It's my opinion. It's you got to watch it TV. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, yeah.
No, I do. And, you know, when reality TV started, it was an opportunity to show some people that were very interesting. And along the way, the industry realized that they could save a lot of money by not doing, you know, serial drama and just throw these cameras in front of people and just let them act the fool and we would follow them. But a funny thing happened. They became successful. Yeah. And so as a result of that, the industry really has changed. They're not making as much television as they used to make. They're not making as many dramatic shows as they used to make. Because the cheap thing is to just throw somebody up there and follow them around in their house and let them act crazy, and then you pick it up. And that is disheartening, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, Donald Trump himself is a creature of reality TV. You know, I was actually thinking about this because Ronald Reagan in 1980, go, oh, he's just a B actor from Hollywood. But compared to Donald Trump, he's a statesman of the highest order.
Yeah.
I guess it's an indication of how society has declined that when you think Ronald Reagan.
Based on what you just said, I was trying to remember this movie where this comedian, was it Robin Williams, where this comedian ran for office and people voted for him because he was so funny. He didn't really have a plan. I'm trying to remember
was that the Warren Beatty one?
It was one of them. And the reality is that if a really good comedian got up and ran for office, people would laugh their ways all the way into the booth. It wouldn't matter whether they had an agenda or anything. It was just, they'd just be funny. Yeah. And I think that part of the reason why Trump had the success he had was because people had followed The Apprentice.
Yeah, absolutely.
If Arnold Schwarzenegger had been able to run, he would have won.
Yeah.
You know, because people would have loved having the Terminator in office, thinking that that's real. You know, so.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I think that's real. They expect the Perry Mason moment to occur. They expect the Terminator to show up and obliterate the opposition. You're right. We've been trained by the industry in which you've labored for all these years. In other words, it's your fault. I'm blaming you. All right. So let's set the table here for an Oscar talk. I've been watching Oscars my whole life. We're roughly the same age. And it was like my mom would allow us to stay up late to watch the Oscars. I was like, she allowed me to do that because she shared an interest. She had her favorite. So we would be watching the Oscars. And I continued that trend for all the years since. I don't know if I'm going to watch this year's for a whole bunch of reasons. I have a feeling that it was the similar thing for you. But like everything else in segregated America, you were watching from one side of the train track, so to speak, and I was watching from the other. So I'm just curious what it was like to be a young kid, boy growing up in Chicago, watching from the black side of town, as opposed to being a young boy growing up in Evanston and watching the Oscars from the other side of town. So let's talk about that. I presume you were watching back in the 60s when I started watching as well.
Well, yes, I started a little bit earlier, I think, a couple of years. But so when I was growing up, there was a movie theater down the street from us. It was the Joe Louis Theater. And you could go there and they would drop you off and you would pay 25 cents or 50 cents, whatever it was, to get in, and we could be there all day. However, the movies that played there constantly were either Elvis or Flash Gordon. And then they always had the cartoons. They had a whole block of cartoons that were playing. So my reality was I didn't see any black people in movies. So I didn't watch the Oscars until, you know, Sydney was up to win or some other black person was nominated, because outside of that, we were non-existent. We were invisible in that environment. And so there was no real reason for me to watch the show. I wasn't into fashion, you know, so and none of our people were nominated or going to win. Everybody was shocked when Sidney did for the movie that he got the role for. So, you know, he was one of the first actors that actually was doing any work. Belafonte before him did one in 54, but Sidney's Raising the Sun in 59, they could have gotten some more recognition for that. So my reality was that I didn't start watching the Oscars until I got into my teen years and I was closer to getting into the business. Yeah.
The Joe Louis Theater. They named the theater after the great boxer, Joe Louis.
Yeah, they did. It was on 35th Street between Michigan and Indiana. And it was originally, I think, if it wasn't the Pickford, it was something like that. It was originally named that. It was named after Joe Louis. And then once it closed, Theodore Ward, who was one of the founders of the Negro Federal Theater, when Lex Hughes and Richard Wright, opened it as the Southside Center for the Performing Arts. And he had it for about 3 years, and then it went under because he couldn't get enough audience during that period of time.
And I'm thinking right now of Sidney Poitier. You referred to him, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, this is raw memory, that he first won an Oscar for Lilies of the Fields.
That's correct.
Which came out, and I'm doing this totally from memory without notes, ladies and gentlemen. And he was up against Albert Finney. Yeah, I want to say who was in Tom Jones. And this is classic how the world looks like from the other side of the street, Pomone. My mother had loved Albert Finney. I think she had a crush on him, but she wouldn't admit it. So she actually she wanted to cheer for him when he won. And she was so mad. I think I want to say it was Sidney Poitier when he won. I have a feeling, to quote the Beatles, that it was a different reaction in the Pomone Arami house when
he laid it.
Poitier, go ahead.
He laid it. You know, you go from a period in the 1950s with the murder of Emmett Till. There was still lynching going on in the South. The entire country was still segregated. And when you're living in those conditions, it's hard to find things to cheer about. And so small wins can be huge in certain cycles. As a matter of fact, what Sidney represented more than anything was a strength of manhood that we had not seen in movies before him in terms of a black male. And so, yes, we were around the televisions, you know, hoping that he won. And I remember, you know, something that Hattie McDaniel said when she won Best Supporting Actress. And people were complaining about the fact that she played a maid and she got this award. And her response was, I'd rather play a maid than be a maid. And the point of that is, if you are in movies and you are doing them just for the fun of creating, but then you're having an impact on people as well, because a lot of people started strutting like Sidney. You know, Sidney did the first movie where a black man slapped a white woman on film. And when he did it, they took it out. But you saw her reaction shot. And so you were sitting, well, what just happened? He slapped the head of the Klan in They Call Me Mr. Tibbs. I think that
in the heat of the night.
In the heat of the night. And so we hadn't seen that kind of behavior in film before that. And so he represented all of that, which we felt was where we wanted to go in terms of imagery. Now, on the other hand, Harry Belafonte was cast in Lilies of the Field first, but he said he didn't get it. How a black man from nowhere with nothing behind him ends up with five nuns, you know, that were Nazis. So he turned it down.
Yeah.
And Sidney went on to win the Academy Award.
That Denzel Washington, there was a documentary, I want to say, about Sidney. I think it was Denzel Washington reflected on that, how Harry Belafonte, in retrospect, is regaled as someone who took strong stands and refusing to do movies. And Sidney Poitier, in retrospect, is criticized by many for taking roles that are arguably demeaning to black people. And Denzel Washington had a great response. I'm going to destroy it by not accurately paraphrasing it, but it was along the lines of Harry could sing. So if he could afford to turn down movies because he could just go to Vegas and make a fortune singing and his record sold, so he could take a high and mighty stand. Sidney couldn't sing. And I think the thing was like day o day. You know, he was like, Sidney can't sing. Yeah. So he had to take it. Yeah. So
I never felt in watching and even looking back now on Sidney's roles that he did anything that was damaging in terms of image. Even in the one he did with Tony Curtis, I mean, they were running away, but he still found some morality and expressed a different kind of person.
Yeah.
Sometimes now when we're looking back, we're looking at things through contemporary eyes and not through the time that it existed in. But people were around the block every time his movies came out. Was that bad? No, I think at some point you have to have the sacrificial lamb that goes through all of the issues that are represented by the industry. They take the slings and the arrows, and then you can then turn around and be proud after they've done the battle, which is the hard thing, which is opening the door and letting people in. And one thing, you know, about the Academy, there are over 300 movies made every year. And so you can't possibly judge all of the movies that come out. Yeah. Which means that you are rooting for that which is closest to you or people that you like. You know, that's just the way that happens.
So when you see Sidney Poitier from The Defiant Ones. And this is a movie, ladies and gentlemen, came out in the 50s. A black man and a white man, escapees from a prison work farm somewhere in the South, and they're chained together. And that's the premise of the movie. And they're running away from the cops or the prison guards, etc. and so forth. They're chained together. And Tony Curtis, it's kind of unbelievable anyway, who's a Jewish guy from New York, is acting like he's a hardened Southern criminal, which is so preposterous to begin with. And Sidney Poitier is acting like he is a hardened criminal from a work camp. And I just like, it's so absurd. I've watched it recently, okay, or at least portions of it. But it was such a liberal movie that was appealing to liberal sensibilities and the notion that we are good even though our country is bad. And there's that moment that white liberals love where Sidney Poitier is on the train and Tony Curtis, the racist turned good guy, is running. You remember this scene?
Right, he
and Sidney like grabs his hand to try to pull him up the train, and he ends up getting knocked off the train. And at the time, I remember, oh, like tears in my eyes. That's Sidney. That, what a great guy. I got a feeling it was a different response.
Yeah,
you had a different response.
Let him go. you know, essentially, when you look at movies where you project change in people, and human behavior is really kind of interesting anyway. And so you set these bad people up to find each other, and then you find the good at the end. There are a lot of plays that are like that, that are religious plays. And you can expect in the beginning of the play for the person to be anti-God. And at the end of the play, they're going to find God and sing a great song. You know, that's how they're structured. And just by the way, two pieces of trivial information. When Sidney did that Defiant One, Ivan Dixon was the stand-in. And Ivan went on to do Hogan's Heroes, to direct The Spook Who Sat by the Door, to be in Car Wash and a bunch of things. But his first job was as a stand-in. And you mentioned Tom Jones. When we did Mahogany, the director, Tom Jones, I can't remember his name now, but he was the original director for Mahogany. And yeah, he did the first maybe couple of months with us. And then Berry Gordy fired him and took over as director. Tony Richards.
The British guy. I know.
Yeah.
British guy,
yeah. So I had to work with him for a few weeks and then to work with Berry Gordy after that.
Wow, man. I did not know that little piece of history. I'm pretty sure his name, I can look it up later, but I'm pretty sure that's who it is. Listen, I'm just, before we move on and get into Oscar, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm unapologetic, and this is my generation and my upbringing. I am unapologetically a huge fan of Sidney Poitier. He's right up there with Paul Newman as my favorite actors as a kid. I never got into the Elvis movies, I'll be honest with you, Pomona. I never, you know, I just never got into them. I saw them all, you know what I mean? Like, that's what they showed. So I, right. And I'm from a liberal family. We were taught to detest John Wayne. So I never got into John Wayne movies, but I just, to this day, love Sidney Poitier. I love the way he carried himself.
Yeah.
And the dignity that he had, and when he slapped the racist, and it was huge, man.
It was
huge. Even for white liberals, it was like, damn, he had a white guy. Yeah. And
no, it was major, and a lot of places in the South wouldn't play the movie, and because of that. But being able to find your dignity in that environment during that period of time and maintain it. Because Sidney, through the course of his career, had no major incidents that caused people to attack him in the press. I mean, he didn't have any bad press, you know, overall. And so what he represented was this man, you know, in this industry that was mastering it. And the if there's any tragedy to it, is that fact he didn't have more opportunities, you know. And the industry was changing. People were changing the way that they look at movies. And I think a lot of times we don't realize the importance of film because it goes well beyond just having a good time. What we consider to be heroes in film become heroes in our lives and a reflection of what we want to be. And so, you know, I don't take that lightly. And I think that as people look at movies, they should explore what is the end result. When I talk to young filmmakers, I basically say there are three things that you should keep in your head. The first is, why are you doing what you're doing? The second is, who are you doing it for? And the third is, what do you want to do after they watch it? And those, none of those have to be political. They can be, well, I want to do a love story because I want to motivate men to treat women better. And at the end of the movie, I want everybody cheering and jumping up and down in the seats and going out. But if you don't address what you want the film to be, then the criticism that you receive might not be fair. because, you know, you can say to me that I bake. So you cannot tell me that I can't bake. What you can say is you don't like German chocolate cake, but you can't tell me I can't bake. And it's the same thing with creating films. You know, we create these worlds and you hope that people will accept them, hang out with you in the world for a minute, and then learn something from it in the process.
Yeah. You were absolutely correct. Good memory. Tony Richardson was his name, the British director, and he did direct Tom Jones, and Barry Gorey fired him. Damn, that's so deep. That's a power play. Barry Gorey, and he said, I'll direct it. Go ahead.
And you know what? And I actually, you know, I probably shouldn't say this, but I actually think it was a power play. I think that the whole time it was set up for him to come in and for Barry to get his chops into the Directors Guild. And that's what happened. You know, he went on to be a member of the guild and to put that film out. But I think a lot of the people that came on board, including Anthony Perkins, was because Tony Richardson was directing. I don't think they would have got the same cast if they said, Barry Gordy, and he does the music. You know, so yeah, I think it was part of the plan.
Part of the plan. Wow. Power move by Barry Gordy. It is the behind the scenes representation of the on screen slap, right, by Sidney Poitier. Yes. For Barry Gordy, a record producer to fire this distinguished director. I'll show you. I could, anybody could be a movie director. That's the story. All right. Let's talk about the Oscars.
Okay.
Is a reality. So how does it work? Go ahead.
Okay. They're members of the Academy. And to be a member of the Academy, you either have to be a member of SAG or a director and or actors. And during the season, they send out screeners of all the movies that are being made.
Now, that sentence are producers.
The Academy.
Oh, yeah.
And they ship them out to their members. But everybody doesn't do screeners. You know, they used to send you send DVDs to the house, which had to be very expensive. Well, now they send links online that you can go in and you can watch the movie at your leisure. However, as I mentioned earlier, there are over 300 movies being made every year. How many of those, if you're on the Academy, can you actually watch? In the period of time that they're sending them out. So they send them to you, then they send you a ballot, and then you fill the ballot out and you send the ballot back in. And that's how the process works. But I want to talk for a minute about, as a judge for films, because I've judged them for a lot of the major film festivals. The first thing that you want to do when you're judging a film before you vote is look at the film quality, the style, the expertise in capturing the images, the editing, you know, that kind of stuff. That's one classification that people need to look at when they're making the judgment. The second is storytelling, the ability to tell a story and captivate narratives or have a strong voice or point of view. That's the other part that you're looking for when you deal with it. Then creativity, the strength in storytelling, in a new and innovative way, exploring new subjects or subjects that people have not necessarily seen. And then finally, even though it's not as part of the rules, you always respond to what you feel about it. Whether you admit it or not, at the end of the day, what did the movie make you feel? If you saw the movie and you got on the phone and you called all of your family members and said that they've got to go see this movie, then it's been effective. If you don't call anybody, then it's a failure, you know, because that's how it builds up. So those are the standards in terms of how people look, supposedly looking at the films. All right, but let's go back to that 300 number. You get Oppenheimer, American Fiction, Fall of the
Anatomy of a Fall.
Anatomy of Fall. You get all of these movies in. Which one do you watch? Because you can't watch them all. So what drives you to watch any of those? Is it DiCaprio? Is it Jeffrey Wright? Who is it? And what is it about that movie as a member of the Academy? I'm not talking about people, because people are being moved by marketing, which is why, you know, you have a good opening weekend and then the second weekend nobody's there, because they found out that the best part of the movie was what was in the commercial. After that, it was just horrible. But once it goes to the members of the Academy, and these are people that you know, then it comes down to, oh, well, you know, Sylvester Stallone is doing a movie. I'm not watching that one. We can just go beyond because he doesn't deserve anything. And then they'll look at someone else and they'll say, okay, well, they automatically, they've never gotten one before, so we're going to vote for them. And I'm not suggesting in any way that it's a conspiracy of a group sitting around making those decisions, even though it might be. But I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that it is subjective. And yes, too many times it is left up to favoritism or popularity. If you're a popular actor and you've never had an award, it's a great possibility you might get one this year, you know? So anyway, so yes, so that's how it works.
Okay. So I'm going to translate this into some practical examples since it's so subjective. So you have all these movies to watch, and then after that, that's when you vote as to which one should be nominated. Is that how it works?
No, that's when you get to, they've been nominated.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah. Now they've already been nominated. They send you the movies out and they send you the ballots.
Got you. Okay. Wow. So who nominates the movies themselves? Like literally nominates, like decides that Anatomy of a Fall, for instance, should be considered eligible for the best movie category.
The Academy members that are closer to, like Whoopi is a member of that select group.
Got
it. I know she's one of them. And Robert Townsend is part of that group in terms of two people that I know. Okay. And they get to, I think, do the first wash.
Yeah.
And then it goes out to all of the Academy members after that.
All right. So that's the first cutoff. When you talk about, so that's the first cutoff. And this is my theory, and I'd love to hear your response to it in terms of how this works along racial lines. There's two possibilities. One is just normal, what I'll call likes and dislikes, or personal, what you're attracted to. And in a segregated society, Black people will be attracted to movies that feature Black people, and white people will be attracted. This is a segregated society, Pomona. That's just the way it is. Will be attracted to movies that feature white people. So it's like, who would you, when you see a movie, like, you're like, I want to be like Sidney Poitier. I want to be like Paul Newman. It triggers a personal response. Okay. My mother, I love Tom Jones, or Albert Finney, etc. Then, so that's like a gatekeeper. White people are not attracted to movies with Black people. So they're not even going to watch it, or they're not even going to consider it. Then there's just out and out prejudice. So I believe, and vigorously counteract, come at me if you disagree. I believe, for instance, that white people, to a large degree, cannot stand Spike Lee.
Mm.
Something about Spike Lee that really irritates them. Okay, I mean, he's not humble. What, they'll never say it, Pomone, or maybe some will. But it's like he's too arrogant. He's not humble. He thinks he's all that. I'm so sick of his movies. Like, it's not, you're not going to see in a Spike Lee movie the Black character reaching out his hand on the train to the white character. You'll see in a Spike Lee movie the Black character say, I'll see you later, pal. That's my theory. Go ahead.
So I'll push back a little, because based on our participation in society here, Black people have more of a tendency to watch movies that would be considered white than white people have in the consideration of Black movies. Because If I was to ask some of your viewers that were white, name me 10 black actors. If I asked a black person to name 10 white actors, they'd be able to name them. Because there's something about the entertainment, because it was so long before we were able to see anybody black in a movie, that we began to identify. Like I heard Sam Jackson, I think it was Sam Jackson, talk about how even he liked Westerns. And even though he liked the Westerns, he, and there were no black people in them, he saw himself as the cowboy. Because he could translate that into the kind of hero that he wanted to be. He did not watch that movie because it was white people in it. I didn't watch Elvis because it was a white person. We accepted the fact that he stole from Jackie Wilson and created this form that he had, and people got into his music. Flash Gordon was one of the hokiest TV series ever. Yeah. But, you know, that little spaceship flying around the rock was something that we were able to get into. So I think that what this society here has done is made us believe that imagery has something to do with our ability to understand each other. And sometimes it doesn't. An example. There was a toothpaste that came out in Japan that had a person in blackface on it. It was called Blackie, or get rid of Blackie for cleaning your teeth. And people bought it, and people bought it, right? Even though it was extremely racist. Now, what's the first thing that a black child has traditionally saw in the household? A white baby on a jar of baby food.
Yeah.
So the first thing that they see and associate with good is this white baby's face as they're fed by their parent. It has impact. Now, does that stop black parents from going out and buying those jars? No, it never has. Because in many ways, we have become everything that's associated with America, and sometimes I think we believe it more than other folks do, that we are truly American. And being American represents the ability to be connected, respected, and involved, and accepted. And so a lot of times the movies that we're writing is about explaining to other ethnic groups what we are, who we are, and getting them to try to understand us. There are some filmmakers that write specifically to black audiences or Asian audiences to say, this is what our behavior is. And it's written for us because we want to modify our own behavior. But movies can do both of it, you know. So I was in a class the other day, and I asked these students, we were talking about what movies we would make. And I said to them, if I was the head of a studio, and someone came to me with the idea of doing this, the movie of Shirley Temple, mm-hmm, I would say, okay, that's a, you know, good idea. Child actress, she was an ambassador, you know, good idea. However, I want to show it through the eyes of Bojangles, who was the black dancer that danced with her in most of the movies. Now, why would I say that? Because I have a direct connection to that character. And so what a lot of black producers are faced with on a continuous basis is when they go to other ethnic groups and they ask for financing, that other person will say, well, you know, how do you include me? You know, why should I be able to watch this movie? Why should I want to watch it? And the answer should be because it's a love story. You know, it's a rom-com. It's a, you know, if you could eliminate the fact that there's some black folks doing the same thing that somebody else, Jennifer Lopez, or somebody else is doing in a movie, if you can get beyond the limitations that you place on it because of color, then you might actually enjoy the comedy or the love story, because ultimately that's what it is.
Mm. So going back to Elvis, which there was a play that was in Chicago. I think it was Jackie Taylor did it. It goes, I'm paraphrasing the name. Elvis Presley was a black man. I think that's what the play was. And it was produced at the Black Ensemble Theater. So it's mostly black actors singing Elvis songs. And the whole point of it was to underscore how much he was, I'll say it euphemistically, influenced by black musicians of his time. Some would say how many just he just appropriated or stole, what have you. It's that's a debate, how what word choices you have. Did you think about that when you were absorbing Elvis?
Not at all.
Okay, go ahead.
Not at all. I mean, I kind of liked Elvis. You know, I liked the outfits he wore. He was clean. You know, Elvis had some nice outfits. He always got the girl. You know, he did. And even the, you know, the way he danced. And the reason I referenced
Jackie Wilson
is because if you look at the old Jackie Wilson videos, it's the same movement, the same choreography, it's the same style. And Jackie Wilson, of course, was out before Elvis came along.
Now, Elvis has admitted that he emulated Jackie Wilson, and I could go on and on. And Mick Jagger emulated, this is the biggest joke. This is one of my favorite. Mick Jagger emulated James Brown. And I mean, Mick Jagger can't dance. See, this is one of the weird things, Pomona, about race and culture. Look, people, like I could go on and on. Mick Jagger can't dance, people. All right, Rolling Stone. I'm not saying he's not a good singer. I'm not saying they don't write good songs. I'm not saying he's a charismatic performer on stage. He's cool. Whatever you want to say, but he knows fashion. He can't dance. The notion that you promote him as a great dancer is an insult to great dancers.
I might have to disagree slightly.
Go ahead.
Do you remember the Elaine dance from Seinfeld?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that was so bad that it became famous.
Okay. Yeah.
I think Mick Jagger's dancing was so bad that it was good. You know, that because the way you watch it, you know, he had energy. He just did.
Can't dance.
Right.
Okay.
He's still doing it. But they're amazing to me. They're still dancing around, you know. So
I mean, just an idea popped in my head in the 80s. I hadn't thought about it, but there was a huge, oh God, I forget the name of it, a worldwide concert to raise money for Africa, and I think it was came from the Michael Jackson song.
We Are the World.
Yeah. Anyway, so Mick Jagger's on stage with Tina Turner. Who can dance? Right. I'm like, what? This guy, it's like he's doing aerobics. This is not dancing. This is jumping up and down.
Yeah.
And one of my friends are, Ben, is that the point? whatever. That's the guy.
You know, as we have gone through as an industry, a lot of growth, and that growth is directly connected to society. And so what you see is movies changing as we are challenged by the things that are happening socially.
Yeah.
When you look at Oscar Michaud, and Oscar Michaud is considered, you know, one of the prolific black filmmakers. He was making movies starting in the 1919, and he made 40 films. But people were critical of him. Right. They were critical of the quality of the movies. They were critical of the fact that he was just trying to replicate things that were being done in Hollywood. There were all kinds of criticisms. And so when I was on a panel and I was brought up, I said, OK, but you do know that that was 54 years after slavery. And that's not a long time. The first film school wasn't opened until 1921, and that was out in California. So where were people supposed to learn movies? They would learn them by watching them, and you watch the ones that are out, and then you try to replicate what that is. And so, Michelle, even though you can be critical, you have to, again, look at it through the eyes of back then rather than now. The first black soap opera was done in 1970 here in Chicago. It's called Bird of the Ann Feather, written by Richard Durham, and it was produced at PBS. It was the top-rated show in the 1970s. But when they were putting it together, they were talking about a black director, there were none. There were absolutely none in Chicago. There was some guys that were doing theater, but nobody had done film or television. So Okoro Harold Johnson, who founded the ETA Theater, went to Boston for a six-week certificate to come back to be able to direct that show.
Wow.
When you look at the tape of the shows, you can see the fact that these are first-time directors. You can see the fact that these actors had never gone to acting school or done any major work. But so you have to accept it for the time. If you're comparing it against a movie that's being made now with exceptional cameras and dollies and it's just unfair. It's unfair to do it. You have to look back at why the piece was produced and to what extent did it move the needle in society? Because that's why a lot of them were done. There in this documentary that I'm hosting in a couple of weeks, they were talking about the impact of black films with movies. Shaft, the Isaac Hayes soundtrack, was the first movie that did not use classical music to underscore the film. Superfly, Sweetback, and some of those films were the first ones to release an album before the movie came out. And the albums made so much money and gave so much publicity to the films that the industry changed and began to do the same thing. Those movies also created the first anti-heroes. After that, the industry again changed. And so every incident that we go through in time, I think, impacts the stories that we want to tell. There's a lot of, things about LGBTQI issues now that are being generated in the industry. There's a lot of female-related materials being generated in the industry. And all of that has to do with the pushback that was being done out in the streets by people saying, these are the kind of movies that we want to see. Ava DuVernay has had an enormous impact because she has helped. And I do think that it's disappointing she didn't get an Academy Award nomination for Origins. But she's helped to get a lot of women and a lot of people into the industry. And she started making movies when she was 35. And I have to tell the story because it's funny as hell. She said, before she became a movie director, she was a publicist. And she was a publicist on movies. And her direct quote was, "These people are stupid. And if these stupid people are getting money to do movies, I can do that." Yeah. And she did. And now she's one of the biggest directors in Hollywood. So it's not brain surgery. But you do have to be around good people.
All right. So you mentioned Shaft and you mentioned Isaac Hayes. So let me ask you this. Why is that Shaft, Isaac Hayes, overwhelming? I have no idea what the vote was, but won the Oscar for best soundtrack. But the movie Shaft was not nominated for best picture. I would argue that the influence of Shaft as a movie, which includes, of course, the soundtrack, had as many reverberations as the soundtrack did itself. It was emulated by dozens and dozens of movies throughout the 70s that included white movies and black movies. Okay? So I would argue, and then people go, "Ben, have you seen Shaft lately? It doesn't stand the test of time." Well, yes, they're absolutely correct. It does. I'm embarrassed. I liked it so much. But come on, people. Think Rocky. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly great filmmaking there, okay? If you watch that one lately, yeah. And it won an Oscar.
Right.
So he won an Oscar for Sylvester Stallone, won an Oscar for Best Picture of the Year. And Shaft didn't even get nominated. Now, come on, help me, Pomona, on this one.
I can't help on that one. What I can say is that Shaft sold more leather coats, I think, than anybody else in history. Because everybody went out and bought a leather coat. You know, it's just what it was. No, but you know, again, that was one of Gordon Parks' first movies. He'd done Learning Tree before that, but he had very little experience. Richard Roundtree was a model who they plucked from Ebony Fashion Fair and gave him the job, so he had never acted before. Sheila Frazier, who was the love interest, she had a little theater background. So what do you expect when you're just sort of at this point letting people in the door that have never been in? Yeah, I mean, look back at the movies and say, man, they were crossing, they were cutting the lines, and they were looking in the wrong direction. They didn't do cutaways. They didn't show the fruit that he was eating. Right, all of that. Because they hadn't gone to school or they hadn't seen enough movies. Two quotes. Someone asked, dang, what is his name? That did Jackie Brown and
Tarantino.
Yeah, they asked Tarantino, did he go to film school? And his response was, no, I watch movies.
Yeah.
Interesting point. And then Robert Townsend said that, you know, one weekend I was talking to him, he said, I'm watching every movie that ever won Best Picture at the Academy Awards. And the reason is because I want to see what is the similarity, what's the continuity, what is it about those movies that make them great? And it's that level of study, it's that level of filmmakers getting in there and saying, okay, I don't want to just make money. I want to be great. And I want my movie to be remembered in 100 years. But most people either just want to work, or they have no real concern about, you know, quality as long as they get a check, you know.
All right. So since you made reference to Jackie Brown, which we could do a whole show on Jackie Brown, it's one of my favorite novels. And I don't know if you noticed, written by Elmore Leonard, the protagonist is a woman who beats the man. So it's a classic black exploitation movie, but she's a white woman. So it's not even black exploitation. It's just woman's exploit. I don't even know what to call it, but it was Tarantino, when he bought the rights from Omar Leonard, who switched the protagonist to a black woman played by Pamela Greer. And since we're talking Oscars, I'll marry these two subjects. In my humble opinion, I realize there's real outrages and then there's like diversionary outrage. So this is a diversionary outrage. But one of the great outrages of all time is that Pamela Greer did not even get nominated. That performance was unbelievable. Everything you want out of a movie star, Pomona, just the way she carried herself, like you fell in love, or me. A whole generation of guys my age fell in love with Pam Greer all over again, and she didn't get nominated.
Yeah, no, most certainly. You know, she really does deserve, even if it's a special Academy Award, because the term you use, black exploitation, that era of what is defined as black exploitation saved Hollywood. Hollywood was not making money. People were there was the same old kind of films, and it invigorated that industry in a way that no one expected, and had great success, which is then what led to the black exploitation movement, which was the studios rushing to throw anything together that they could to get in on that money. And the example that I worked on a movie called Monkey Hustle. Some years ago. And when they called me about doing the film, they said, well, we've got James Earl Jones and Lou Gossett, and we're going to do Monkey Hustle. When they got to Chicago, they had Rudy Ray Moore and Yaphet Kotto as the two actors. But when I talk about exploitation, there's a scene at the end of the movie where they have this big block party. And as we were pulling the people together for the film, they said, okay, we're going to have this block party and, you know, we're going to feed everybody and you have to come out because we need a big crowd. So when they get out on location, they had lettuce. They had a plate of lettuce and told the folks to act like you have some food in front of you. When they were renting people's locations, they were not paying them what they should have. When they were hiring extras, they weren't paying them what they should have. The actors were underpaid. Very few Black directors or writers were hired on those films. Well, that has an impact on the outcome and what they and what they're going to do. I think Jackie Brown did not get a nomination because of Tarantino. And I think that the industry has a funny relationship with him. And some of his movies have really been very good. But I think the combination of language and subject has made a lot of people stay away from awarding it. Because sometimes you don't want to reward the hero because of what the hero does or what they accomplish, or the anti-hero, depending on, you know, what role they're playing. So,
yeah. Did you enjoy Jackie Brown?
I did. You know, I was at the History Museum, Chicago History Museum yesterday for a meeting, and this guy just blurted out at some point that a friend of his in some other state was having a meeting and called him up and said, "Guess who's in the office?" He said, "Ooh, Pam Grier." Guess who was in my office? He said, "Who?" He said, "Pam Grier." And she was here for like 2-3 hours waiting. You know, he said, "And you calling me now that she's gone?" I have loved her since the movie came out, you know?
Oh, Lord, that's funny. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's our generation. There are so many people I know that love Pam Grier. Shout out Sergio Mims. May we rest in peace.
Yeah.
Dear friend. And we shared a love for Pam Grier. And I remember she came to town to sign copies of her books. And he went, he got to meet her. And I couldn't go because it was my youngest daughter's high school graduation. And he was funny because he was like, "Are you crazy? You're going to skip this for your high school grad?" And it happened every year. Pam Grier doesn't come to Chicago. I'm like, "God damn, man."
That's funny. That's funny.
So, all right, we're going to close this down because I could talk for another 2 hours with you about this. This is just a delightful conversation for me. But we'll close with this. Just connect this in some way to the Oscars, which are going to be held in 2 weeks. Are there any movies this year that you're just... You said it's all subjective. Granted, I totally agree with you. Are there any movies that you are just rooting for, that you're like personally rooting for this year?
American Fiction. American Fiction has my vote in a number of categories. And for number one, I think that the subject is so necessary. And it's across the board. I mean, it's even... People that are writing now are challenged with who are they writing for? I talked about that earlier. But also, how much garbage do you put out? Mm-hmm. You know, because some people, like you have Christian rappers that do gangster rap because that's what the studio told them they had to do to get a deal. And then they'll say to you, "Well, you know, as soon as I get this deal and I make my first million, then I'm going to go back and do my religious songs. It kind of doesn't work like that, you know, once you're in that stream. And so I love what American Fiction represented and the message that it has about what we see and also about what we write and what we'll do for money, you know, because some people just do anything. Yeah. You asked me something when we were talking earlier, and it was off mic. You asked me who didn't get an Academy Award that I thought should.
Yes.
I couldn't sleep last night because that question bugged me the whole night. Yeah. And I would have given Best Actor and Best Actress to Angela Bassett and Lawrence Fishburne for Tina Turner.
Yeah.
They should have at least been nominated. Those were incredible performances.
We could do a whole show on that and why. I mean, I truly don't understand. I would put at the top of my list Pam Grier for Jackie Brown. I would put on my list, not getting it, Denzel Washington for Fences. Unbelievable. I told the greatest American actor doing the greatest American playwright. Like, close your eyes and just listen to him. It's poetry. They gave it to that guy. I can't remember his name for that, like, melodrama. It's just like, what? I can't even get the words out. I hear what you're. Oh God, I can't even. I'm rooting for American fiction movie as well for a different reason. And the writer, I'm just gonna say this again. Percival Everett wrote the book that movie is based on, which came out over 20 years ago, and it's called Erasure. And it is even more satirical and darker, if you can imagine it, than the movie. And it's kind of experimental the way he does it. He's absolutely genius. I'm in awe of this man. Every novel he does is different than the one before. He writes in so many genres. It blows my mind every time it comes out with a novel. I've just been like a fan. You know how you're like people you're a fan of? Like, I'm never going to be like you, but I'm in awe of you. And this, like, mainstream has recognized him, and it just blows my mind away. And he doesn't care. He doesn't do publicity. You know what I'm saying? He doesn't care. He's doing his thing.
Yeah. I mentioned that my wife is part of the Academy. So we used to go to the Directors Guild in LA on the weekends, and we'd be invited to these screenings. Yeah. And all of the screenings were of movies that I typically wouldn't have gone to the movie house to see. My point is that for your listeners, do yourself a favor and select 5 movies that you normally wouldn't go see. And see them. Just randomly, just 5. I would never go see this movie. Then you'll either agree or you won't. But it will give you an opportunity to see the world in a different way. And I'm glad that a lot of the foreign films are not coming in, because some of them are like really great work, and we typically would not be able to be exposed to them. So I do like the fact that those are included. I have some issues with how that process works, but that's something I'll get different.
All right, we'll come back to that, I'm sure, in the next conversation. This conversation can go on another 4 hours. You have places to go and people to see. And so I'm just going to thank you for coming on. Probably we could do this again next month in the aftermath of the Oscars or whatever. Maybe get you talking politics. How about that?
Hey, that'd be wonderful.
So thank you very much, Pramod, for coming on my humble little podcast.
Thanks for having me again. I always enjoy coming on your show. You're insightful. You're always prepared and engaging. And so call me anytime.
Very good. I will. So thank you very much, Pramod. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.